Oh, well, I couldn't get here on time, so God forbid I should be up here on time. Good afternoon. I'm an addict. My name is Judy.
Judy.
Take my gum out. Sorry. I always start with the same few things, and that is, one, my clean date is January 17th, 1994. I have a sponsor. I have worked the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. I sponsor women in Narcotics Anonymous, and I have a home group. And I was told when I got here, if I could not say all of those things, I needed to sit back down. So that's what keeps me honest, so to speak. And I always kind of want to say one more thing, and that is that I still go to meetings.
Yes.
You know, and I don't know where everybody is. I don't know. Like, in my mind, when I got here, I was a hot mess. Most of us are. Can you imagine if there were no old-timers or dinosaurs or whatever, and it was just a bunch of newcomers trying to work their way through Narcotics Anonymous, you know? So, I mean, it's funny if you actually, you know, we could probably do a whole speaker meeting on a whole day of the dinosaurs on that. But for me, when I got here, and that was 30 years ago and a half almost, there were so many people here with fairly significant, I would say double digits on up. And that's where I learned everything. Because I didn't know squat when I got here. I didn't know anything about Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about the steps. I looked at the steps. I said, I can do 1, 2, maybe 3, and probably 11 and 12. But those ones in the middle, man, they terrified me. You know, I was like, no, we're just going to work around them, okay? And so I don't know what I would have done without the people that came before me. And now that I'm a person that came before, to the newcomers and to the people, not even newcomers, but I say people that are less than 5 years clean, there's still so much to learn. And who's teaching them? I'm kind of preaching to the choir, right? Because we're all here. But I guess what it boils down to is don't stop what you're doing. Please don't ever think that it isn't important that you are here to share your message and experience and strength and hope. And I never know which one I'm going to give out at any one time. I do know I was also told that the longer you stay clean, what it was like becomes a shorter part of your story than what it's like now. So if you asked me to kind of, you know, how short can it be? Well, I've been high, I've been clean, and clean is better. So that would be in a nutshell, okay? And that's just the way it is. And then I go through people who say, oh, you've been clean so long, you don't even remember what it's like. You don't know what it's like out there. Oh, let me tell you what, honey, I have never forgotten what it's like out there. I can remember my first days in here, in the rooms. I didn't even know if I was coming or going. I didn't even know why I was here. I didn't have a problem. What's wrong with you people? But little by little, when the fog started to lift a little bit, and I started really seeing you guys, you know, and you were happy, and you were laughing, and people were enjoying each other, and I thought, there's a secret here. And if I stay long enough, they're going to tell me what it is. And I just thought everybody was getting high in the bathroom. I did. I just thought that's what everybody was doing. And if I stuck around long enough, then you would invite me in to your little club. And I could get this thing that was laying on top of me that would not allow me to live like other people do. And our reading says that the best. Backtrack a little bit, because what it was like isn't, you know, really long. I got clean in 1994, January, right? We didn't have cell phones, okay? We had beepers, okay? And you know, you'd hit that beeper 97 times in one night to get a hold of your guy, and he didn't answer. He didn't answer, and mostly didn't. We didn't have, most of us didn't. If we had house phones, we didn't have that call waiting. We didn't have caller ID. We didn't have any of that. Yeah, we had a rotary dial, right? And you didn't block people. You just didn't answer the phone. You know, I would go weeks and never answer the phone. There was nobody I wanted to talk to except the dope man, and I had a beeper. That was it. And I grew up in Baltimore, Parkville area. Good family. I was a middle child, so I already started with some damage from that. And if you're a middle child, you understand what I'm talking about. And if you're an oldest or a youngest, you're way too self-centered to know what I'm talking about. So, those of us in the middle have our own angst to deal with. But, I mean, my parents were, I mean, we were not anything special. We were middle, maybe lower middle kind of thing, but we didn't know it. We didn't know because everybody around us was. And my mother didn't drink until she was like in her 30s, took that pledge that they used to have. And my father drank a little bit in the earlier years. And then as my sisters and I grew, then, you know, the parties got bigger and the alcohol at the family parties got bigger because then they didn't have to, like all of us kids grew up in the whole group that my parents surrounded themselves with. So we were all usually somewhere else, but it was just part of what we did. And then we hit 18 in 1974 and we could drink. It was legal. Remember, it was 18 back then, not 21. And we were off to the races. And I would say at least, I would say 60% of us, of that group that were, parents were all up here and the kids were all here, are probably in the rooms still drinking hard or dead. I mean, because it just took us all. And so off we went to, and then remember they backtracked and said, oh, wait a minute, 18's too young. So we're gonna go back to making it 21. Those poor kids, they got so screwed. Those ones turning 18 that year. But by then the damage was done for me. And it was just alcohol for me. And I did not think I had a problem and nobody else did. Because we all drank like that. And then I met a man. I'm always going to blame it on a man. Always. Always. Not really. And we got married. His fault, not mine. And he introduced me to cocaine, which I realized at that point was God's way of saying you have too much money. And that's all there was to it. And so I discovered I loved it. And I loved it because I didn't drink as much, which gave me more money to spend on cocaine. And then, all right, now I'm gonna go back in time, so some of you guys might have to Google this. And then there was a young man named Len Bias. He was a basketball player in College Park. He was a first round, I think he was the number one draft pick that year to the Boston Celtics. He went and celebrated free-based cocaine. His heart exploded and he died. Never got to, I don't even know if he signed the contract. And do you know what I said? Wonder where he got that shit. I didn't say, whoa, I'm backing off. I didn't even know what freebasing was at that point, but I knew that I wanted what he had. Because, you know, I could handle it. I could. Then Richard Pryor blew his face up or whatever, freebasing, and I thought, I might have to get some of that. You know? I might really have to do it. And the reality is I did. And I, you know, I started on a path that not only was cocaine telling me I had way too much money, but I also believe that it is the devil itself. And because I didn't look a whole lot different, except I was getting smaller, which was great. And by the time I came into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I was 37 years old. So you can do the math and figure out how old I am. I'm not doing the math for you. I was 37 years old. I weighed 118 pounds. I had this long hair that came all the way down to here. I looked like I was out of Auschwitz. You might have to Google that. And I thought I was hot. I thought I was the hottest thing since sliced bread. I look at pictures of me now. I was walking death at that point. I had an 8-year-old daughter. I had left my husband, and there's, you know, that's like another hour over here of that. And went on a path of destruction the last 2.5 years. And at like Christmas that year, right before I got clean, I was working at all places. You know, God has a sense of humor, I gotta tell you. I was working at Bayview, and if you know, that's the rehab at Johns Hopkins. And I was doing like clerical work and stuff there. And I would leave every day to cop and come back because, you know, I had too much money now at this point. I don't even know how I really don't even know how I managed to keep doing it. But I became an adoptive family that Christmas for the people I worked with. I didn't even know it. I didn't know that's what they were doing when they started bringing me presents. The last day before Christmas, they started bringing me stuff for my daughter. You know, and I didn't realize that that's what they had done, that the people, they knew before me, shocker, right, what I was doing and how badly I needed the help. And I remember thinking, well, that was really nice of them. That's the fog I was in. And it probably took me, I bet I was 2 years clean before the reality hit me of what they had done when I looked back. Because, you know, we have this ability to, you know, my vision is this wide, but if I don't want to look at what you're doing, I'm like this. So I don't have to look at why you brought me gifts. I don't have to look at all this stuff. I don't have to worry about, you know, they didn't give me any money. They were smart. They didn't give me any money. And I was looking for it because I thought, surely they'll give me money for my gifts. And that was the Christmas I wanted to die. And I remember, now I'm a chicken. I wasn't going to kill myself. I wanted to wake up dead. All right? And I can remember that Christmas. All my daughter wanted for Christmas was a Dallas Cowboys. Don't ask me why. We were never Cowboys fans. Starter jacket. She was 8 years old. Remember starter jackets? So that's all I had gotten her. I'm sure it was hot. I don't even remember how I got it. But a few days before Christmas, after the gifts and all came home, I can remember laying in bed planning my funeral. Now, we're not selfish and self-centered, are we? I planned what they would lay me out in. I planned, this is what I'm thinking, right? It made perfect sense to me. Who would be there? Who would cry? How sad they would be? Who would take care of my daughter? So I got out a pen and paper, and I started writing all this stuff down. Now, I didn't have a plan to die, you understand, but I had a plan to plan my funeral, and I saw absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I put on there where the starter jacket was hidden for my daughter so she wouldn't find me. And on and on and on, I had this whole thing written up, and then I rolled over and went to sleep. That's how I planned my funeral, and I woke up and I wasn't dead. And that was it. Like, I never went back to that place again because I had these on. And when I have these on, I don't have to look at all this stuff over here. Except I would have looked really good in the dress I had planned to wear. They were going to have to go buy it. Because I didn't own it, right? I didn't own dresses. Good heavens. 3 weeks after Christmas, my daughter and I moved to Ocean Pines, outside of Ocean City where my parents were living. And they had already come and taken my dog, but I wouldn't let them have my daughter. And I said, we're a package deal. And I went to my parents, just trying to consolidate a little bit. And I went to them and I said, I can't believe I'm going to say these words. We laugh at ourselves, don't we? I went to my father and I said, Dad, I think I have a solution to my problem. Now, I didn't identify the problem, you understand. I just said, I have a solution. And he said, well, what is it? And I said, God is my witness. I'm sorry. I'm going to go back to school and be an addictions counselor. I had plenty of experience, right? I'm still using. It's like the week after Christmas. Can I come live with you and Mom? Can Katie and I come live with you? My mother, at this point, is in Al-Anon, okay? That's the salute for Al-Anon. So she's in Al-Anon, so she has to ask her, that's the Al-Anon salute. She has to ask her Al-Anon friends if I can come live with them or not. Now, I'm sorry, my nose is itching, so she's probably thinking about me up there, shaking her head. So, and if you know anybody that's ever been in Al-Anon, they, on occasion, have control issues, okay? And so I knew there were going to be rules. I knew there was going to be a lot of stuff that I was going to have to do and hoops I was going to have to jump through and all of that. But I also knew in my heart of hearts that if I didn't leave Glen Burnie, I was going to die. That much I knew. And suddenly I wasn't planning my funeral anymore because I was going to go be an addictions counselor, right? And I had been to college back in the 70s, but I didn't succeed there. But I thought, this time I think I'm ready. So my father, caretaker that he is, not an Al-Anoner, my father marched himself up to the admissions office at Warwick Community College and registered me. And they let him. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, right? Because they don't let your father register you. You're 37, 38 years old, and he's going to register me for college classes so I can be an addictions counselor while I'm home smoking crack. Okay? And it made sense to all of us at the time. So he calls me, and he says, Jutes, I got you all registered, but the one class that you want is full. So the woman at the registration desk said to tell you to just show up the first night, and surely the teacher will let you stay. So I did. Okay, not only have I not registered myself, he's done it. I'm showing up for a class which was Intro to Addictions, right? Kind of important to have. And I show up with 3 days clean, maybe 2 days. It was a Tuesday. I arrived on Sunday, so I had 48 hours clean, give or take a little bit. And I'm sitting in the classroom. She starts calling roll and people raising their hands. And she gets all done and she says, and what about you? And I told her, I said, my dad registered me. Do I look pathetic or what? My daddy registered me for school. And they said that your class was full, but that if I came, you would let me stay. And she said, I will. And she became a mentor for me for a lot of years. And she worked at Nanticoke Hospital in Seaford, Delaware, and she ran their detox when they had it and probably wanted to put me in there. Side note, one night she couldn't show up for whatever reason, and her husband did. Imagine my surprise. I'm thinking, I know this guy. Where do I know him from? But, you know, I'm like probably 6 weeks clean, right? At this point, so I'm foggy. And he knew me, and he's like, there you are, how are you? And I'm thinking, and then I remembered, oh yeah, those days at Towson State University. I remember you, and he was on the rugby team, and I was on the women's rugby team, and we had a moment in time, or two. And I'm like, oh, crap, and he's her husband. And she comes in the next week, and she stood in front of me in front of the whole class like this. And she said, so?
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, I'm out of here. She said, I hear you have a little bit of a history with my husband. I said, I didn't even recognize him. She's like, he's got a lame leg. You recognize him, and he does. He had polio as a child. So she said, you knew who he was. But she was joking, and didn't. He wasn't her husband at the time. But apparently they had a lovely laugh. And I learned then that nothing we really ever do remains undercover for long. It will always come out. But I did go back to school, and I did get my degree, and moving on. But at that point, I had two classes that I took, and I was going to meetings, and I'm living with my Al-Anon mother. And so she had this thing where, because she knew that I was doing bad things before I got there, so she put my daughter and I in the same room so that I would not have any privacy. Gee, that was fun. Okay? And so there we are in the same bedroom, and every morning my father would come in, and he would get my daughter up for school, but then my mother would come in and say, you have to get up too, and I'm like, do we all have to get up to get her ready for school? The house isn't that big, right? And then she decided, I had started going to meetings, but I had to be home at a certain time, okay? And so I wasn't allowed to stay for the close. Now, I'm 38 years old, ladies and gentlemen, at this point. And my birthday's in February. So by 30 days, I had had a birthday. Oh, no, you got to be home to put your daughter to bed. And I'm thinking to myself, my daughter could give two shits of a rat's ass if I'm home to put her in bed. She didn't even like me then, right? But okay, so I had to leave because she knew I would get caught up if I stayed. But I went to meetings every day because I didn't know what else to do. And what happened was I got there on a Sunday to my parents, everything piled up in my Bronco. We got a storage thing, was a chicken farmer's place, like a hen house. That was where I put all my stuff. It smelled really good when I got it out, I can assure you. But it did give me some place to keep what stuff I still had. And I started going to meetings. And the first night that I went to a meeting, now I didn't have a problem, you understand. I'm in school to be an addictions counselor. I know it all. I've been in school one day. But I was going to go to a meeting because I needed to figure all these people out who wanted to tell me what to do. So I packed myself up and I said, I will go to an Al-Anon meeting. I'll show her. And I'll see what makes these people tick. And somehow on Route 50, I made a bad turn, and I ended up at the WAC Center at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you have to understand that 30 years ago, we only had like 7 meetings in our entire area. So we were very, very limited in where we could find our recovery. And we were very, very blessed that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous allowed us to kind of take over some of their meeting spaces with them because we had nowhere else to go. The closest meetings to Ocean City were Salisbury. And 30 years ago, guys, you didn't get in your car and drive 35 miles to go to a meeting. You just didn't. That was like another world. If you were going to Salisbury for the day, you had to go make sure that you were going to Sam's Club, okay? I don't even think we had a mall then, or it might have just opened in 94, I'm not sure. But you may have a doctor's appointment. Like, it had to be a multi-purpose day. So you didn't just get in your car and drive to Salisbury every night to go to a meeting. You went where the meetings were. And so for very many of us, it was Alcoholics Anonymous, except for Wednesday and Saturday. Wednesday I had class, so I couldn't go. So I got to one Narcotics Anonymous meeting a week at that point. But I will tell you that in my first 90 days, I did 216 meetings. And I only know that because I kept a little day timer because I thought I was supposed to. No, y'all said 90 and 90. I kind of took it to the extreme because I thought somebody was going to ask me at 90 days about it. I really did. I was devastated that you didn't care. I really was. My little green day timer. I took that bastard everywhere I went. I wrote down the meeting name, who led the meeting, what it was about. I mean, I did it all. I have little quotes everywhere. Y'all never asked to look at it. Broke my heart. I realized at that point I really wasn't that important to the people in Narcotics Anonymous. But I knew no one. So I hate it when I hear from people, it's really hard to get clean because I don't know anybody. Oh, when? You know what? I moved down here with an 18-year-old with 60-plus-year-old parents, and I didn't know a soul except some of their friends. Not a single person did I know on the Eastern Shore. And I did just fine. But God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I mean, that was just it in a nutshell. You know, and so then I got a sponsor, but actually I got two, because I thought if one is good, two is better. And you said, oh, no, 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 no. And you explained to me why you only get one. And I'll be more than happy to explain it to you after the meeting if you are unsure or unclear. But I got a sponsor and I got a home group. And I started doing what people told me to do, which was so totally out of character for me, right? Because normally I'm the one that's proofreading the book, that's saying there's a typo over there, you know, anything to keep these on so I don't have to look out here and therefore look in here. But for some reason, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I started doing what people told me to do. And I remember a girl came to me and she said, would you stand in that corner in stripes and polka dots if it would make you feel better? Would you do it for one day? And I said, absolutely, absolutely. And she said, you don't have to do it. You just have to be willing to do it. And that was the beginning of my willingness. And since I squirreled off, this was the one woman of all the women that my mother went to, the Al-Anons, she was the one who said, let your daughter come. The rest of them said, no. Get your granddaughter, keep her away. She's a using addict. She's this, she's that. You don't want that in your house. She'll bring it in your home, all this stuff. And these were all parents and whatever relatives of addicts. But Sue was an addict who happened to do Al-Anon. Did a lot of that back then, you know, people wore a lot of hats. And she's the one that said to my parents, let her come. Set boundaries, that's all an Al-Anon needs to hear, and let her come. And so she's the one that told me you just have to be willing. And so I became willing because I didn't want to feel the way I felt anymore. And I was pathetic. I was, my skinny little self. If you were nice to me, I was crying in those meetings. I was no longer a badass when I came into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous / whatever meeting would have me. Because for the first time in my life, people were happy to see me. They liked me. They didn't even know me and they liked me, which I just found totally bizarre and without, you know, like any credence at all. And if I wasn't there, they asked me where I was, you know, and I made a decision in my first 30 days that I was going to do anything that you all asked me to do. And I told the people that I kind of hung around with a little bit, I said, if you ask me to go somewhere, I'm going to say yes. I might not want to, but I'm going to say yes, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to show up. So don't ask me if you really don't want me. Like, don't do it to be, oh, we'll ask Judy, and she won't go, so we'll just ask her anyway, and we'll be, no, I'm going. Now, I didn't want to, Okay? Because I'm the one that's standing in the back of the meeting room at the end, and the hair on the back of my neck is sticking up, and my palms are sweating, and all I want to do is go outside, get my vehicle, and go home. Because I don't know any of you. But I stayed, and I waited until somebody talked to me, and it was the hardest thing I think I've ever had to do in recovery, was to stand still after those meetings. And not run out the door and think, oh my God, you're so pathetic. You are so pathetic, you know. And then when they did talk to me, then my eyes would fill all up with tears and, you know, and then I was awful in that brace. But I stayed. I stayed and I did what you people told me to do, and you told me I had to do the steps. Now, grace of God, in my opinion, we didn't have a step working guide. We had mimeograph machines that everybody borrowed, right? Back then, they went to their job or whatever, and they borrowed it, and they did a handout, and it might have had 5, 6, 7, maybe 8 questions on it. And you wrote your answers down, and you went over them with your sponsor, and then they would tell you some things you needed to do, and you usually didn't do them, but, and then you would do the next one, and you would do the next one. But we stayed clean, and we did the work. Now, that step working guide came out, and I saw that first step with 3,047 million questions. And I thought to myself, I thought, I need more information. I need more information on this. And so I did. I tracked down some of the people that were on the committee at World that worked on, and now what I'm about to say will probably be very controversial to some of you, but I'm used to it. Shocker, right? So I said to them, I don't understand. Some of these questions are duplicates. Some of these questions don't even apply. And I'm now at this point, I'm sponsoring women, right? And they all come to me with this little thing and this book, and they're like, I don't know how to do this. I'm thinking, well, I'm screwed then, because I don't know how to do it. And I read the preface, and it did make sense. And if you're sponsoring people and you haven't read the preface, please go home and read it 5 times, okay? Because what the committee told me was, not the whole committee, but the people that I talked to, is that they had initially done a first draft. And they sent it out, you know, and everybody's going to look at it and area and go back to, you know, regional and everything else. And people got their feelings hurt. An addict got their feelings hurt because you didn't put their question in there. I thought my question was really good. Why wasn't it in there? My question was better. Why wasn't it in there? So you know what they did? They said, screw it. And they put them all in there. Okay? When I read the preface to the Step Working Guide, it explains to me why every question doesn't apply to every person. And a lot of people get mad when I say that because they're like, oh no, I make my sponsee answer every single question. Well, I tell my sponsee, asked and answered is an answer. If you feel like you've already answered that question, show me where you already answered it. Refer to question number 7. You know, do a little bit of the work on it. But luckily, I have worked the steps of Narcotics Anonymous 1 to 12 one time. I work on things as they come up. This is just for me. This is what works for me. And whatever step it's on, then I do the work with my sponsor or my friend who's back there, Tammy, who's like, you know, we're like secondary level with each other in the car, typically, driving to things like this. But that's just what I do. And I'm not saying that anybody else should do that. I am just recommending that you read the preface thoroughly before you start working on the Step Working Guide with the people that you sponsor. And I think that's only fair because they wrote it for a reason. So I didn't have that mimeograph, hand me that, hand it back. And then I did the 4-step. Got to the 4-step, which, you know, that wasn't one of the ones that I said I could do, right? I was going to do 1, 2, 3, 11, 12. But I said, all right, I'll do 4. So I did 4. I worked on 4. And my sponsor had me start with a list of resentments For 30 days, I had to keep a list of everybody I ever had a resentment against, ever. Like, I went back to third grade, guys. I went all the way back. And then when I was done that list, we sat and we talked and we scratched off, like, the ones from third grade, you know. And my fourth grade teacher, who told my parents that I was going to be a failure because I would not draw birds. This is a true story, okay? I didn't want to draw birds. I was a lousy artist, and we were spending like 2 hours a day drawing birds, and I don't even like birds. So, yeah, that's what she told my parents. So, you know, maybe I should have worked on that one more, because apparently it's still an issue. So, but anyway, after we scratched off the ones and I started doing the writing and I got done and I went to my sponsor and she was painting her bedroom. So I grabbed a brush and a roller and we painted and we did my fifth step. And I really didn't feel a whole lot of anything other than the fact that it was done, because this was coming up on my second anniversary. So it would have been like 1996. And back then, everybody was in your face. What step are you on? You'd walk into a meeting and they'd say, how many meetings you go to this week? What step are you working on? Why are you still working on that step? You know? And then you'd share in a meeting and they'd say, what step was that? That's what they did to us, to keep us accountable. Now, I asked a guy who had been in my home group and suddenly kind of went off, you know, the radar screen. And he had just celebrated 1 year. He'd had 5 years relapse, celebrated a year, worked for my son-in-law, so I kind of knew him. And I called him on the phone, and I said, hey, how's your recovery going? Are you still going to meetings? And he got offended. He said, not that it's any of your business. He said, but I'm going to 2 meetings a month. And I said, well, it kind of is my business, because the basic text tells me that we are each other's eyes and ears. And so I haven't spoken to him since. The week after I did, that's just a little side note. Yeah, we are in each other's business, I hope. And I'm running out of time, so I can't believe I'm running out of time. I'm only on step 5. Who moved the clocks up? What the hell? We'll finish this out in the parking lot. But the week after I did my fifth step, where I just felt like, okay, it's done. Nobody can ask me that anymore. We got to move on. My sponsor fired me. Well, she fired all of us, and she sponsored a whole bunch of us, and I was devastated. And I went to you all, because that's what I learned to do in here, and you said, this has nothing to do with you. Oh, yes, it does. I just did my fifth step, and she's walked away, and I'm celebrating. And they said, it's not about you. It's not about you. You just keep doing what you're doing. You'll keep getting what you're getting. I went on. I worked the rest of the steps. Now we're really digesting here. But I will tell you that for me, the 12 steps come down to 6 words. And that is clean house, trust God, and help others. And if I can do that on a daily basis, then I'm doing everything that you guys promised me I would be able to do if I got in here and I stayed clean. If you are new in the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, it ain't going to be a bed of roses every day. People aren't always going to be nice to you. I have been betrayed and humiliated and hurt, and I've had terrible things. I could do another meeting in the parking lot on that. But you know what? At the end of the day, I haven't gotten high for over 30 years, and I can't even imagine what would make me get high. You know what? I just can't. You know, and they say, well, the death of a child. Well, you know what? The only way I can get high if my daughter dies is if I get high the instant I'm told. The minute you tell me that my daughter may have died or my grandboys may have died, something like that, I got that minute. Wow. Okay. I got that second to do it. After that, it's a plan. And I have no plans, because God has met me at the level of my needs for the past 30 plus years. I did get my degree. I did become an addictions counselor. I bought a treatment center. which I have run for the last 26 years in Salisbury, outpatient, and as long as I keep doing what I'm doing in here, I will continue to get what I've gotten in here. Thank you for letting me share.